Hey there, welcome back to Cannabis Insider. I'm Pato Little, and joining me is the incredible, the one and only Abby Higginbotham.
Thank you, Pato. Right back at you, always hyping me up. March is Women's History Month, though, and we are celebrating by featuring women who are leading the way in the cannabis industry every episode this month. Today, we are thrilled to have Erin Gore, the founder of Garden Society, with us. Erin's company is known for its high-quality cannabis products, and she's a true titan in the field. So we are so happy to be kicking off this month with her.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Garden Society has made a significant impact under Erin's leadership, and we can't wait to dive into her journey and insights. So let's go.
Erin, how are you doing?
Thank you so much. What a sweet introduction.
Absolutely. We're just happy to have you on. But if you're ready, we're just going to jump right into the interview.
Let's do it.
All right.
All right, Erin. It's great to have you here with us, especially as we celebrate Women's History Month. And also, first interview of March. So for those who may not know, please tell us a little bit about yourself and what do you do?
Yeah, so my name is Erin Gore. I'm the founder and CEO of Garden Society. We started in California in 2016, so we're a legacy California brand. We're now operators in three markets. So we're in California, Ohio, and New Jersey, where we run our own manufacturing. And then we also manufacture products for other leading brands across the country.
Fantastic. Yeah, said it well. And kind of building on that, we won't focus on too much, but I do want to ask, your advocacy for women-owned businesses in cannabis is well known.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how do you see kind of Garden Society contributing to more inclusive industry? I we're jumping right into it, but
Let's just go there right away.
Go there.
You know, it's so funny. I was talking to one of my union reps this morning, and we talked about this specific topic. I don't know if it's because it's Women's History Month or just because it's, I seem to talk about it every day, honestly. When I started in corporate America in 2006, it wasn't that long ago, but it was long ago. They had to build me a bathroom in the plant. I was the first woman to work in the chemical factory on the south side of Chicago. And they had to build me a locker room because the only women's bathroom was in the marketing department, which was like half a mile away. And so it was a really interesting kind of preview, I think, for what the future of my life was. I was a chemical engineer in school. I grew up in the Midwest in Wisconsin. And so I think my entire corporate experience was almost defined by creating and advocating for women. I was the first woman to ever work in the plant, which was weird in 2006. Like, how's that possible, right? I had an incredible executive sponsor, this gentleman, John Mecha. I say men are women's best allies and advocates, which I truly believe. John helped us found the employee resource group for women. It was the first one in this huge $30 billion company. This was, you know, 2009. I ended up having a really incredible career at Henkel. I ended up building the footwear business into a $134 million business. So footwear adhesives, where again, I was the first woman to ever win business of the year, first female executive to run a global business unit in that way at this company. And so transitioning into cannabis, I was steadfast on building a culture and a brand and products and a company that stood behind the diversity and the leadership I wanted to see in the corporate world that I didn't have. I had incredible mentors and I was given incredible opportunities, but I also went through a lot that we don't have to talk about, but I went through a lot to get there, right? And it made me tough, it made me gritty, it made me resilient, it made me question everything about me, made me successful because that was life. But in the meantime, it really helped set me up for what I'm trying to do in cannabis. And it also is like really core to how I'm building this company. You know, as women, if you look at the statistics, like less than 1% of women were funded in the last 2 years compared to all the capital flowing into the market, all the startups going into the market. If you're a Black woman, it's 0.001%. So it's incredibly, incredibly difficult if you're a woman of color. If you're a woman, you're held to a different standard. Even when I was fundraising in the early days of Garden Society, I had men ask me, prominent investors, who I still see at MJ BizCon, how could you be successful if you have a baby? I don't understand. But yet my male colleague had a baby, on and on and on, right? And so both raising capital, operating in new markets, being an executive and managing HR, you know, all the aspects of building a company. I think women are just incredibly disadvantaged because of how the culture is, right? But it's also our superpower if we could do it. And if you can like really work together and get that support of other women. So for me, it's core to what I do, how I do, advocating for women, mentoring women, calling out, why don't you have any women-owned products on your shelf? Like there's some stores that still have never stocked us and still won't. And it's crazy to me how people, especially cannabis operators in today, cannot actually support women. So yeah, that's just a little bit of a backstory that a lot of people don't know about my experience of why I do this.
No, I absolutely, you know, you were talking about it. I don't want to go in detail in it. Please do. I mean, obviously, like you have this experience. I love how candid you are too, talking about it. I know, please do. That's what the show is about. I do have a quick follow-up to that though. And you kind of like delved into it a little bit is, you know, with all that you've experienced, like what changes, and then I kind of want to go into products, but right now, what changes would you like to see to support women entrepreneurs in cannabis kind of moving forward?
I mean, the most obvious one is access to capital, right? Like in this industry, you can't do anything if you can't raise capital because the cannabis industry is so capital intensive. There's no financial services to wrap around to support us. So like really funding and supporting women. I have been blessed with an incredible ecosystem of investors who support me and see my leadership and see what we're able to build and my incredible team. You know, I've turned and kissed a lot of frogs to get to this point. So there probably isn't an investor I haven't talked to. So it's like really hard work and really being gritty and tough meets like, you know, I say like raising capital is 90% hard work, 10% luck. And, you know, for me, finding those people who believe in my vision and my skills as a leader and really get behind me and through the good and the bad, because it's been really, really tough, as we all know, right? So I feel lucky and I want to help other women and create that. The other thing that I think the best way to support women, I say this all the time, is to transact with women. So like do business with them. It's not a charity case. It's not like you should stock me because it's like, no, people like want our products. They're incredible products, or I'm incredible at making product. Like my team's just, you know, really, really special. And so like transact with us, like, you know, buy and sell, do, you know, and that's like, honestly, one of the best ways you can actually support women. If you're a consumer, it's buying women owned or diverse owned brands on the shelf. If you're a retailer, making sure you have diversity in your shelf placements and the brands you support. If you're an ecosystem of like you're a B2B person and you're buying in the supply chain, like, are you buying from women? Are you actually looking even to see if they exist out there? And like, they probably make a better product at a lower price because we have to compete. So that's what I really think the best way to support women and diverse owned brands. And, it, you know, I want to be acknowledged of my privilege that I have in the sense that like I did have the ability to gain a lot of experience in corporate and bring that into me. But I also like cut my teeth in the early days of cannabis and love this plant. And, you know, it's been really difficult and challenging, as I'm sure all your guests talk about on the show. And so I hope that we can come back to a sense of community, because that's what made this industry so special in the early days. And I feel like through the pandemic, like any sense of community was basically squashed, right? Mm-hmm. And then coming out of it, the challenges of the industry are so difficult that like there's so much infighting and arguing and there's so much scarcity feeling versus like, hey, we're all in this together. And like if one wins, we all win. And like really trying to like reset and reframe that, I think is really what's needed, especially to support women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's really surprising that these days we still need to underline the importance of transacting with women. I mean, if you think about it, it's not only, I mean, it's like the smartest choice you can get as an entrepreneur in cannabis, to be able to diversify your commercial and also, your managing capabilities. Yes. And shifting gears to Garden Society's offerings. I mean, I didn't know you were a chemical engineer, so that's even more interesting for this question. Your approach to crafting cannabis edibles and pre-rolls is quite unique. Can you dive into how you maintain such high quality and sustainability standards in your products?
Yeah, good question. So one of the things when we started the when I started the company, maybe quick my journey into why I started the company. Mm-hmm. So I ended up having both my hips rebuilt, my first one in 11, my second one in 2012. I was a college basketball player. I'm 6'2", if anybody knows me. And so I had really bad chronic injuries. And so I found cannabis as an alternative to opiate, like so many people. Mm-hmm. For me, it was, I didn't want to take Ambien. I didn't want to take Percocet. I was in excruciating pain. And so in 2008, I had moved to California. I got my medical card. I started going to dispensaries. And I had a very interesting journey with early day edibles. Some were like this, some were like that, some were like this. So I ended up being a chemical engineer. I love to cook. I love to bake. I'm really into the science of it. I ended up creating my own lab. I make my own tinctures, my own hash, my own extract. I started making my own edibles because I could make them consistent and homogeneous. And I knew what I was getting. And I could vary the cannabinoid profile. So this is like early days, CBD, THCA, people didn't really do that, right? And so fast forward in the company, so I had this career, I ended up quitting, and I set out to build Garden Society, which at the time was community and products for women. Now we're less about products for women and more about products for everyone, but focusing on craft and quality, because that's where we feel like we're differentiated. We're really proud that over 60% of our customers are men because they love how our products taste and hit and feel and smoke and all of that. What I started with in the early days was that I was just going to use another manufacturer and a co-packer because I didn't need to build a factory because clearly people could do this well, right? Hypothesis is wrong. So I ended up realizing I couldn't find a co-packer that could do it consistently with food grade standards. I mean, I have early day stories of finding like rat shit in all our packaging and we had to like dump a whole load of packaging or like, you know, just problem. And so we ended up finding a license building. We got our license. We said, okay, we're going to just do it ourselves. And then we started doing it ourselves and we're like, oh, we do this really well. And then all of a sudden we realized, okay, we should do this for other people from a mere means of cash flow alone, honestly. Mm-hmm. And then we realized we were good at doing it for other people. So one of the things that I think is so important and critical to manufacturing products is process. I'm actually a Lean Six Sigma black belt. And so you can teach anyone anything if you teach them correctly. And if the process is documented correctly. So we have pages of SOPs and pages of documentation. And it's a continual improvement process for us. We're constantly updating and getting them better. But like really understanding what it takes down to every single detail to make a product and then making that such that anybody in our facility can do that and follow those instructions to do that well. And then taking it and being your own self-critic, right? And saying like, okay, this is our process today. Now, how do we scale? How do we clean it out? How do we get it better? How do we continue to like drive up the capacity without driving up the cost? And so that's the journey we're on. And it's an everyday process. Anybody who says that manufacturing is not continuous improvement isn't really manufacturing many products because absolutely. When you really start to scale that thing, it gets really challenging really fast. But that attention to detail, and we have an incredible team, and that's really what's propelled us to be able to make consistent quality products. We also have really great partners. So in addition to Garden Society, we're manufacturing products for PAX, for Jetty, for other leading brands. And these brands see the quality of the products we make and value that in their brand and their products and have been great partners to us to enable all of us to scale together.
Awesome. Sorry, Erin, I was listening. My connection cut and kicked me out, but I am.
Oh, you're good. You're good.
I did want to say, though, you seem like the kind of person that you know, you want to do something, you go after it and you do it. Because you mentioned slightly in there that you're a black belt. Is that correct?
Well, for Lean Six Sigma. So like, black belt, Lean Six Sigma is like nerdy process engineering, not karate.
but even from going from basketball to just even this industry in general is fascinating. It's amazing. And I love the nerdy science behind it. I do want to kind of switch over though, kind of talk about legalization, you know?
Sure.
It's something we'd ask all guests. We kind of hear the same sentiment, but you know, with recent trends in cannabis legalization across various states and the conversation mm-hmm. around federal reform, how do you anticipate these changes impacting your company and the craft cannabis segment as a whole? Like, is there expansion maybe in your future?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is like, they need to, you know, figure out the war on drugs and incarcerated individuals. Absolutely. Like, it's unbelievable that as a white woman, here I am making millions of dollars off selling marijuana, and there's people incarcerated for this across the country today. Like, that absolutely, fundamentally, like, talk about advocating for the right thing that needs to be addressed and managed and resolved, right? Secondly, I think legalization is going to be incredible for garden society, especially if we go Schedule 3. I know it's controversial. A lot of people don't like it. Being a chemical engineer and with our background and how we operate, we actually run GMP facilities and we have standardizations in place. And so for us, like, actually having access to traditional financing is going to be able to get us to scale more economically and more efficiently and, like, really be able to build an incredible business. And we already operate in a manner set up for that. So when the time comes, and if it does go HHS Schedule 3, we're ready. We're ready to go. I think it's a really interesting rude awakening for operators who are not operating in a mature process, professional manufacturing environment where they don't have GMP policies. They don't know how to do HAZAP trainings or HAZAP analysis. They don't know how to do these things, and they don't. So they might be able to operate at a lower cost basis, but that's not how food production, especially edibles, should be done on a national stage, right? Like we, like all the food manufacturers, I spent, you know, 11 years going into large CPG food manufacturers for food safety. And it's done a certain way for a reason, because consumers deserve that level of safety and protection. And I think when it comes down to cannabis products, it's exactly the same. So what I hope happens on a federal legalization landscape is that they do move it to Schedule 3, capital markets open up really quickly in whatever way that looks like, whether that's financial banking reform or, you know, investor capital or debt options come down to reasonable rates, like whatever one of those, or probably all three of them actually. And then I hope what happens is there's some level of like interstate commerce or some level of like, hey, my state program isn't functioning well, your state program isn't functioning well, and we have the opposite problem, let's work together. So with manufacturing in Ohio and New Jersey, like New Jersey has the opposite problem as New York, New York has problems and New Jersey has problems. But I can see those borders opening up and like collaborating across border in that ecosystem, which would be tremendous for us as manufacturers in New Jersey. So I think it's going to be an exciting time. I do think I was talking to somebody this morning, one of my investors, and I just think it's insane that I've been in this industry for 7 years and seen literally no progress. And at the federal level, and my investor's like, well, of course, Aaron, like, did you totally underestimate special interests and dysfunctional government? And I was like, clearly I did. I think also what's going to be really interesting is like, how does the hemp farm bill play into this? Because that's the sleeper out there that is really impacting the industry on an illicit scale and also like a legal scale, if you will, right? So the D9 agenda, the D9 beverages being sold at BevMo and in bars, the D9 gummies being sold at gas stations across the country. Like, what does that mean for low dose intoxicating cannabinoids? And how does that impact regulated marketplaces? And how does this all come together? So I think it's going to be hopefully reform in the near future. I think it's going to be exciting, but I also think it's going to be like wrought with more red tape and challenges and bullshit. But we've gone through a lot of it already. So like, well, what else? I mean, like, let's go, you know, like, here we go. Let's go.
I love that attitude. Yes. And actually you painted a great landscape for my next question. As someone deeply immersed in the Northern California cannabis community and also with a presence in Ohio, New Jersey, you were just talking about how the different pieces in the puzzle of the federal cannabis landscape all comes together with the different realities of each state. So how do you see the role of local markets evolving the broader cannabis industry, especially with the potential shift in the federal policy maybe coming in not long in the future?
You know, it's really interesting. I just asked some advisors about this last week. We were talking about this. It's like, how does this play out? Like, what is going to happen? So Senator Gillibrand from New York, she's leading the Farm Bill Initiative. And I had lunch with her not too long ago. And I asked her, you know, what is your intention around intoxicating cannabinoids for the farm bill? And at the time, she didn't really have a position on it. So what I think is really going to be instrumental is, does that loophole close or not? And if the answer is no, which is what I expect to be the case, that it does not actually change, then I think what you're looking at is a legal THC landscape in the States that's like a high dose, high intoxication THC marketplace and a low dose, low intoxication national distribution platform where it's under a certain threshold, whether it's hemp, whether it's cannabis, whatever, but it's a low dose, like more like the seltzers, if you will, versus the alcohol, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so I think that states and the federal government are always going to be on opposite sides of the coin and bifurcate this situation. I think it's going to be really challenging until the intoxicating hemp industry is regulated through the FDA. So if the FDA steps in and says, we're going to regulate gummies or drinks or whatever, then I think you're going to start to see more equalization across it. But it's going to be really challenging for the next stretch of time while this is all in the gray landscape. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's a question, Bully, but
yeah, I don't know. Absolutely.
I think it does. And I kind of want to talk about, like, as obviously legalization becomes more widespread and it mm-hmm. opens up the door for more people who are curious and trying it. And, you know, Garden Society kind of focuses on creating products that resonate with Canna Curious and mm-hmm. those looking for a seamless, you know, cannabis experience. So with the increasing like interest in like microdosing and wellness oriented products, so how is your company kind of adapting to like meet those customer preferences?
Well, so what's really interesting is not to correct you, but I don't think that's actually the consumer necessarily that's trying to find cannabis. I think it is in some markets, but I think like, for example, in California, it's a high dose cannabis loyalist, cannabis enthusiast, right? In California. In Ohio, our most successful product line is actually concentrates. So we launched, a lot of people don't know this about us in Ohio, but we launched concentrates, we launched hash. Ohio's in no smoking market right now, so you can't do pre-rolls. So it's all dabbing or vaporization. So we launched a hash line, we launched a live rosin line. They're doing incredibly well in the marketplace. So meeting that canna consumer where that canna consumer is, versus who we think that consumer is, right? And it was our mistake when we launched Ohio. We launched with low dose edibles and they were like, nah, I don't want this shit. And so we're like, okay, like redraft, retool. And now we kind of hit our stride in Ohio. So when you think about like who this canna curious consumer is, I mean, that's who the Delta 9 market is really serving. Somebody mm-hmm. wants to order it on the internet, order on the DTC, it ships to their house. It's a beverage, it's a low dose gummy. You know, there's that consumer. For us, we are really passionate and advocates for the plant. We love getting high. We love making high potency products. It doesn't mean it has to be super psychoactive, right? Like high THC, we can make my favorite products that we make are high CBD products because it's rare to find efficacious CBD in the marketplace anymore. So mm-hmm. like we make an incredible THCV cannabinoid product called our Joyful and Present line. It's a pre-roll that's a one-to-one strain. And then we also have a gummy that's a one-to-one. So if you've ever had cannabis-derived THCV, it's really an incredible buzz. It feels good. You're social. You're focused. It's not super psychoactive. So I think we really focus on efficacious products and then delivering that brand value. So ensuring that consumer knows what they're going to have, how they're going to have it. So if it's like a grandma who's 92 who needs CBD, here's a gummy for you and here's how you use it. Just don't eat the whole bag because you forget you have one. THCV, if it's a high THC product, we love those too. And we have those offerings. So I think that's what makes cannabis so special, that you can actually create efficacious products that deliver on those feelings. But I also think that's what makes marketing and branding so incredibly difficult in this space, is because you don't really have the data and you can't really tell and talk to the consumer about it because of all the limitations in marketing. So I do think at the end of the day, D9 in the hemp intoxicating cannabinoid marketplace is good for the industry because it is showing there is a legal marketplace for cannabis, right? If you look at Texas, Florida, all these markets where D9 is exploding, it's showing that consumers want intoxicating cannabinoids, and it's showing that consumers are trying to consume less alcohol, consume less pharmaceuticals, and this plant and these products have a place. Now we have to figure out how do we regulate it and how do we merge these two defunct systems so that it makes sense for everyone. The businesses can succeed, the consumers have food safety and all the like safety mechanisms, and then in between, like, everybody plays nice and pays their taxes. So I think that's the challenge ahead, but I feel really inspired by what the consumer base is saying and how people are transitioning. People, a lot of people know this, but my husband's in wine. And so he's a farmer and he works for Constellation Brands. And so he's the biggest wine, one of the biggest wine companies in the world. And a lot of my friends are in the wine industry because we live here in Sonoma County. And it was so interesting. I was talking to one of my friends yesterday. We went out for a walk in the break in the rain. And she was like, oh, her, like the wine industry is down 18% last year. So people are drinking less. And I was like, why do you think that is? And she's like, well, baby boomers are dying. Yes. But like those people who had a bottle of wine every single day, every day they had wine, every day, right? So they're dying or they're having health complications and they're told they can't drink as much because now they're on this treatment or this or that, right? So all of a sudden they want to be intoxicated, but they can't consume alcohol in the same volume they used to. So now they're turning to cannabis. They're trying other things. They're not drinking alcohol. And then the new young kids, the Gen Zs of the world are like, I can't afford it. It's not healthy. I don't want it. I want cannabis. I want intoxicating cannabinoids. I want psilocybin. I want mushrooms. I want plants in whatever form that looks like. So it's, I think, a real positive for our industry. If you're my husband, he's like, this is terrible. But for us, I think it shows that our future is really bright. And now it's about how do we weave them together to be a high functioning ecosystem.
Absolutely. That is a really full of insight, an answer full of insights. And there are also a lot of, we can do, I mean, trace a lot of comparisons between the wine industry and the cannabis industry. And you actually, again, painted a great context for my next question. I love the way you structure your answers. But recent news highlighted the challenges and the opportunities in the cannabis supply chain management. And given Garden Society's commitment to responsible farming and strain-specific cannabis, how do you navigate these challenges to ensure consistency, product quality?
I think it's a great question. So for us, we have a really robust intake process for cannabis intake because we don't really have any good analytical systems we can rely on to test. We have to have trained individuals, knows. We have some work we do with the lab for R&D, but we have to look for mold. We have to inspect everything clearly. We have to have really good processes there to be able to understand the product coming in is of the quality we need. And then when we start making the products, we have to have the right production process in place and the right downstream quality control process in place to ensure we produce it. First time right is something we talk a lot about. So first time right and on time in full. So we make it right and we make it in the right amount. And then when those two things happen, everything else kind of falls in place, right? Because if we have the system to make it first time right, then we pass testing, we go through the analytical hurdles. You know, one of the things that I think is going to be a really interesting situation, if you look out 5-10 years from now, is what impact does cannabis regulatory testing and pesticides, mold, fungus, all these things, heavy metals, what impact does that have on other CPG industries? So shampoo, I tested shampoo and it failed like atrociously compared to weed. And I'm like, wait, I put this on my hair. I wash with it. It goes in my eyes and it's shampoo, right? Wine is another one where manufactured goods, wine's a manufactured good. And so if you compare it, so cannabis is being held at this very, 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 very high level, which I'm actually okay with because you're eating, you're smoking, you're consuming it, but the rest of our standards are much lower. So I think this is going to play out really well for consumer safety. I think it's going to cause a lot of impacts down the road to CPG and food and egg and wine, and nobody's going to like it. It's why I tell the Farm Bureau they should support us and lobby with us because it's just going to roll downstream.
Absolutely.
But those kinds of things ensure that we have good quality up front and that we don't have product recalls. We don't have problems downstream. And, you know, we are not afraid to make the hard decision. I think that's the other thing is a lot of people are like, push it out. No one will notice. Well, if it doesn't pass our quality standards, we reject it. We rework it. We reuse it. We throw it away. We're not afraid to say no because if we don't say no, somebody else will tell us no, you know?
And you're really good at segues. I was like, this goes perfectly into the next question too. It's just, and it's lastly, like your journey with Garden Society, it's kind of a testament of dedication. Even just talking to you right now, I can hear that in the cannabis industry. So what's next for Garden Society, though? Like, how do you plan to kind of continue evolving the brand?
Let's sell this shit, baby. Who wants to buy it? Just kidding. So we're standing up and we're launching in New Jersey right now. So we're like full steam ahead, crazy, intense, as fast as we can. I don't know if you saw the exciting news we announced maybe last week, the week before. We just acquired Chemistry. So it's another, I call it the brother brand to Garden Society. It's a vape line, tincture line, beloved California brand. One of the most award-winning Emerald Cup vapes in California. We needed to bring more SKUs to market. We needed to have different technology. So we're specialized in edibles and pre-rolls and concentrates. We really needed vapes and tinctures to round out our portfolio offering. Paul, the founder, has been a longtime friend in the industry. And we looked a few times to figure out how to work together. And it just worked out right that we could look at acquiring Chemistry and bringing it in-house and working together. And he rounds out our leadership team. So we're super pumped for that. We're launching some really fun new SKUs. So we have some new minor cannabinoid gummies coming, like CBC and CBG. And so that's really exciting. They're delicious. They make you want to dance. It's really fun. And then we're launching in New Jersey. So like, it's intense, it's crazy. And then I've been told I'm not allowed to do anything else. I think my husband tells me that the most. He's like, can you just chill? So I'm like, yeah, we need to execute. We need to chill. You know, it's going to be a really hard year for the industry and a wild time. So, you know, I never will say opportunity won't come up and we won't continue to try to do stuff. I do believe like 1 + 1 = 3. So I look forward to seeing like what else we can acquire, JV, or how to build the most impactful, meaningful national cannabis company in the smartest way that really returns for our customers, our team, our investors. And I still, you know, look forward to kind of figuring that out.
All right. Yeah, no, it seems like there's big things on the horizon for you. And final question. It's more so, where can people find more information about you? Where can we find products? Can you kind of give a little bit of a shout out?
Yeah, totally. So you go to our website, www.thegardensociety.com. You can check out our Instagram at GRDN Society. We're shadow banned, so Instagram's bad. like everyone, we're shadow banned from all social media. But go to our site, go there. You can find us across California. So on our site, we have a finder. So wherever you're at, you can log in your address and find us in California. You can find us across Ohio. You can find us launching in the next 60 days in New Jersey. And then you can shoot us an email, Erin@thegardensociety.com, if you want to connect with me directly.
Perfect. Lovely. I think my computer heard shadow ban and just kicked me out. I'm not sure.
I know exactly.
I'm not entirely sure, but.
I mean, that's like the best thing. If HHS goes Schedule 3, can we finally do marketing? Finally.
Oh,
can we get rid of shadow banning once and for all?
Yeah,
there's so much effort put from some companies and people to promote their products and all their effort on social media just to get banned from one day to another without explanations.
So quick.
You could just have like imagery. You could say like the word forget to bleed.
And there's no like rhyme or reason. As much as you know the rules, there's no rules. And then it's like who you know and who you have to pay off and how you get it on shadow banned. Yeah, and then you just get shadow banned again.
Oh, gosh.
So it's definitely challenging. I have an incredible team. Maggie Connors is our VP of marketing. She was the founder. One thing I think is a really interesting situation with Garden Society, our leadership team, we're all ex-founders or founders, and then now they're working at Garden Society. So everybody brings a really entrepreneurial lens, scrappy. Everybody's super passionate about the plant because you can't be in this industry for this long if you're not. It's too hard. And so, you know, Maggie does an incredible job with our marketing, with the limited budget she has and the limited ability she has just because of the nature of being plant touching and everything with it. But I'm proud of being here still 7 years later. I'm proud of, you know, taking risks and trying to do things different and growing and going into these new markets as the operator instead of just licensing our brand. And, you know, I think it's going to set us up to have a really breakout 2024.
No, that is great to hear. And also, that's also a great note to leave us off on, Erin. I loved hearing your insights. I loved your energy. And thank you so much for your time. It's been a fantastic thing talking to you. And until next time, of course.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, that's it for today's episode of Cannabis Insider, a really interesting one, if you ask me. And so a huge thanks to Erin Gore for joining us and sharing her incredible story and insights. And of course, thanks to all of you for tuning in.
Yes. She was really fun. I'm really glad that we had her on. Make sure to go check her out. But also, don't forget to follow us on all of our social channels for the latest cannabis updates. And check out Benziga.com for more in-depth analysis and upcoming events in the cannabis world.
That's right. And we'll be back soon with more stories and insights from the forefront of the cannabis industry. Until then, stay informed, stay green, and bye for now. We'll be right back.